Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexrode. Marquise Munson taking you through this Thursday morning here in Nashville, Tennessee. And Joe, we were talking earlier, you know, the NFL opt-out deadline is today at 3 o'clock Central Time. Were we going to see a wave of players start to opt out? Well, you have some breaking news on that front, don't you, Joe?
And I've got to thank our friend John Glennon for his retweet of Tom Pelissero, who had the report, I believe he had it first, on Lucas Niang, a rookie tackle, supposed to start for the Chiefs, opting out. As Glennon points out, well, potential starter, probably a starter. They've already, I'm bad with, these are not great name people for opting out. Niang and then Laurent Duvernay-Tardif.
Sure, yeah.
I think I got that right. Starting tackle. He's already opted out for the Chiefs. So you think about the Chiefs right now. All that this has just been an incredible offseason. They get Mahomes locked up, but beyond that, Chris Jones, they're able to, you know, basically keep this thing together. I love their draft. I love Edwards-Helaire at running back.
Yep.
I think he's going to be a really nice piece, you know, for that team. And all of a sudden, you're running out of tackles. You're running out of the people who are primarily responsible for protecting possibly the best player in the NFL. Not great. And it just shows you can have all these plans and have everything set up, but this thing, everyone's an individual looking at differently, different considerations, and this is a real concern for the Chiefs. This is a real potential problem for them. You talk about two offensive tackles that you were absolutely counting on.
They're done. You heard it here first.
Yeah, 4-12.
Done. Chiefs
City
are done.
Chiefs.
The Raiders are going to win the division led by Marcus Mariota. You heard it here first.
Goodness.
Mariota's going to the Raiders, and he's going to be the starting quarterback by week three. He's going to do exactly what Tannehill did last
year.
Damn
right they are.
And the Raiders are going to the AFC title game.
Yep.
You heard it here first.
Yep, they are. With Marcus Mariota, how you feel about that?
I'm glad, I do want to ask you, Raiders fan, because I still don't totally understand this. The whole sending out the pictures of
the offensive
offensive weapons, but Derek Carr is not in that. Why is that? Tell me. Explain that to me. Does that mean Mariota's starting?
Look, this is what I've gathered from Gruden so far that he's been there. And this is kind of like the one thing that I've gathered, because he really doesn't tell you much. I don't think he likes Derek Carr. I don't think he believes in Derek Carr. That's why Derek Carr came out with that quote recently saying that he's going to wear the Kobe sleeve pretty much this whole season, because Kobe gave him advice, you know, after, you know, Derek Carr's injury back in 2016, and he's going to wear the sleeve with Kobe Bryant with mama mentality, you know, because he's basically feeling like he's got a chip on his shoulder. And I just think, look, he's in the wrong situation, because I just don't believe that he's Gruden's quarterback. I don't think Gruden wants him to be his quarterback. So hence is why they got a guy like Mariota. Hence the reason why that they were in talks of getting a guy like Jordan Love in the draft, which they end up passing up on. But I think if they didn't sign Mariota, they would have drafted Jordan Love. And that's no doubt. They would have drafted Jordan Love if they didn't sign Marcus Mariota. So I just don't think he has faith in Derek Carr. I think Derek Carr's good. I think he's fine. But me saying that Derek Carr is going to lose his job is not credit to Derek Carr being a bad quarterback. It's just John Gruden just doesn't like him. And Alan probably doesn't like him. I'm not saying personally, but as a player, he's just like, nah, I want somebody else. So that's what it is.
Marcus looked good in that silver and black, man.
He does.
Yeah.
So maybe sending that out was just like sending a little message. Hey, Derek.
Step your game up.
I don't know. I mean, I look.
Well, maybe Mariota's just an offensive weapon. I mean.
That's true.
Look what the Titans did with him before
maybe
he left.
But
maybe
the point is he's going to be
Be a sub-package guy, man.
And that's what I thought, too, because, like, when you look at the Raiders' offense, like, they drafted Lynn Bowden, who's from Kentucky. And he's going to be one of those guys that is going to be a package guy. He's going to play running back sometimes. Sometimes he's going to play wide receiver. He may even play quarterback sometimes. So I think by calling Mariota an offensive weapon, it's not really saying that he's going to be starting quarterback. It's like, we're going to use him for sure, but we're just not going to tell you how.
TBD.
He may be starting quarterback, or he may just be a regular guy on the roster.
One thing on the Chiefs, and I was wrong, Now, Duvernay-Tardif, that is a starting guard. So, and actually, apparently with Niang, the idea was possibly to move him inside. So this is, could actually be more of a problem for the interior. Now, the Chiefs have also had Damian Williams opt out. Now, they drafted, they're fine with what they, you know, drafted there. You know, Niang was the third round pick. I've seen people say that's the steal of the draft. I saw people that had him projected as a low first round guy. He was a guy that, you know, was certainly on the Titans' radar. They took Isaiah Wilson, but this actually could be more of an interior issue. They've got one starting guard out, not tackle, and then they've got, if Niang was going to be moved inside, then that's, but either way, you're talking about two people who were probably going to be involved in protecting Patrick Mahomes who have opted out. That's not ideal.
So, Munson, I want to go back to something real quick. Are you telling me that Marcus Mariota is to blame for the Raiders not drafting Jordan Love and now he's on my beloved Packers?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great. It's all Mariota. Look,
life comes full circle.
I can guarantee that if they did not pick up Mariota before the draft, if Mariota would have just held out like Cam Newton did and just looked for a better opportunity or a better job or a starting job, I strongly believe they would have drafted Jordan Love with their second pick in the first round.
And now he's in Green Bay and now running Aaron Rodgers out of town, baby.
You have a quarterback of the future. Everybody was complaining about Aaron Rodgers when he got picked. Oh, but Favre, what are we doing?
It's a little different.
A little different, but I see some parallels.
Aaron Rodgers hasn't come in and out of retirement like three times. It's a little different.
That is true. But he is getting there.
They did just go to the NFC title game as well.
But I think that's another situation where it's just Matt LaFleur is probably like, look, I want to go a different direction with my offense. And no offense to Aaron Rodgers. I know he's the best. But I'm going to go with Jordan Love. Sometimes, and it's a dumb decision, in my opinion, but.
Oh, it's dumb.
I mean,
there's no question about that.
Because, look, if I was in a situation to where I had Derek Carr or had a choice of Derek Carr or Aaron Rodgers, I'd probably be like, hey, Derek Carr, you got to go, dog. Like, Aaron Rodgers.
Probably?
Like, yeah, probably.
Yeah, 100%.
100%. Guarantee. Aaron Rodgers will be in a Las Vegas Raiders uniform. So I think that's just the situation. The same situation with Gruden and the Raiders. The same situation with Matt LaFleur and the Packers. It's just sometimes coaches get there and they're just like, yeah, this guy's good, but I want to go a different direction. I want to win with my own quarterback. Some coaches got egos like that where it's like, I'm going to pick up a guy and I'm going to win with him and not Aaron Rodgers, who is the best quarterback in the league.
So you're thinking LaFleur in 1 year had that kind of sway on who they picked? I know coaches, different teams have different levels of –
yeah, but why else would you pick up Jordan Love when you don't have any receivers?
I'm just saying, I don't know for sure that it's LaFleur saying that or it's the, you know, I mean, is it the GM? Is it him? Usually they work together in concert on some level. I think the hard part for a Packers fan like Robbie is, man, how many weapons have they ever given to Aaron Rodgers? What? How much time does he have left?
Zero.
And why would you not want to maximize this tiny amount of time you have left?
Well, doesn't it feel like – they're not going to win a Super Bowl this year. Aaron Rodgers is great. Davante Adams is great. Aaron Jones is really good. They're not going to win Super Bowl. Like, they're not good enough. Like, offensively, they just don't have enough. So, at that point, you're talking about Aaron Rodgers being 37 years old. He's got one Super Bowl. Like, as talented as that guy is, and at the highest level that he was playing was probably far and away the most gifted quarterback in the NFL, maybe one of the most gifted we've ever seen. Doesn't one Super Bowl from him kind of feel like a waste of time? Like, it just you left so much on the table with that guy by not surrounding him with the pieces he needed to be surrounded with.
Yeah, it's and if you're him right now, basically thinking one more run at this thing, maybe whatever, not one more season, but you got one last push here, please. It's an incredible receiver draft. Give me, I mean, think about Davante Adams with
Justin Jefferson,
guys,
I mean, it's unbelievable. And just think about, like, the Packers, the last 30 years they've had basically Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers, and that's it. And they got two Super Bowls to show for it. Now, two Super Bowls is nothing to scoff at.
Sure.
But you feel like you go through a run of Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers, start creeping into maybe the four Super Bowl reigns, five Super Bowls.
But would you say Favre had better weapons?
I mean, Favre had Sterling Sharp.
Yeah.
He had
Donald Driver.
Donald Driver was really good. Robert, my gosh, how am I?
Didn't both of them have Greg
Old man brain.
Greg Jennings?
Yeah, they had Greg Jennings.
They both
yeah.
of them had Greg
Jennings. Mark Jamuro, you know, I mean, they had, yeah.
And don't get me
it
wrong.
Was like Greg Jennings kind of, and he was a heck of a player between both of them. That's true.
Don't get me wrong. Like, Davante Adams is really good. Like, when you're talking best wide receivers in the league, he's in the top 10. He's really, really good. They just have nothing behind him.
Right.
It's unbelievable.
Give him some help. I mean, look, if the Jordan Love era ends up resulting in multiple Super Bowl wins down the road, then you'll look back and say, hey, I was wrong. You don't know, but right now, for Aaron Rodgers in particular, it's an insult.
It is. 4 years left on his deal. They can basically get out after 2 years. So 2 years from now, assuming Rodgers is still somewhat like he is right now and still playing at a pretty high level, that quarterback race to get him for San Francisco or Minnesota or whoever's in a quarterback race at that point, going to be something to monitor for sure.
You got to think Jordan Love is like the future quarterback of like the NFL if you draft him
yeah,
for the guy with 4 years left on his deal.
Yeah, no question about it.
Robert Brooks was another guy.
Robert Brooks.
I knew, yeah, really good player too. Now, Favre certainly got more support in that way than Rodgers has. Weaponry.
It's depressing.
Yeah.
But Aaron Rodgers did have the great Charles Woodson.
He did.
On the other side.
Super
the great, Bowl. The great Charles Woodson.
True.
He should have won a Super Bowl with the Raiders, but whatever. I digress.
When we come back, we'll dive back into the Preds, react to Game 3. Hal Gill will join us at 9:30. That's on the docket for the rest of this hour. This is Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, Joe Rexroad taking you through this Thursday morning. Real tough loss yesterday for the Nashville Predators in Game 3 to fall behind 2-1 in the series. And Joe, man, it was a game that they controlled, I think, pretty much from the start of that first period on down into the third period. And then three costly mental mistakes end up being the difference. Matt Duchesne's offside to take away the goal from Kyle Turris. Gets lost in coverage. Connor Garland does, coming back down the other way on the rush. Ekholm, Grimaldi, and I think Bonino were on the ice, all shifting towards Derek Stepan. Garland comes in by himself, scores the goal. And then the Predators are trying to fight their way back into the game, trailing 2-1. Craig Smith takes an unnecessary penalty, and the Coyotes make them pay on the power play. Taylor Hall scores to make it 3-1, and it's game over at that point. That's a tough result to have when I thought for large portions of that game you were in complete control of what was going on out there.
No doubt. And you and I had the same thought. I think a lot of people watching probably had the same thought, and maybe some people involved in the game had the same thought when the Duchesne offside happened. By the way, offside.
There's no S.
I say offsides. But I say offsides, I write offsides.
No S.
I feel like this should be, and actually Vingan helped, and John Glenn and Vingan deserve credit because they're like, yeah, it's off, you know, remember, it's offside, not offsides. I feel like this should be like we have Canadian writers who write color or favor
yes.
with a U.
Yes.
And I think that the Americanized hockey term should offsides should be allowed. But that's just me.
That's fine.
Regardless.
It's offsides in football, isn't it?
I mean, do you always say offside? Yeah, it's in football.
I do always say offside, but that's because about 5 years ago I conditioned myself to always say
battered it out of you, yeah. So, that moment, I think a lot of people had the feeling that, see, that's the type of thing that is just, it's going to cost them the game.
I tweeted it right after it happened.
Yeah.
I tweeted, I said, you know what, I hate to keep harping on this Matt Duchesne offside play, but that's exactly the type of play that'll get you beat. Sure enough, got him beat.
Yeah, Scott Burnside had a tweet there, too, during that time. And I think I retweeted both of you, but he was basically like, you know, the human, I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it right in front of me, but like, you know, the human aspects of this are so magnified in this thing. And you just look at that situation where you're standing at the blue line, you know, and here you go. Watch this much hockey every day. The human element is magnified tenfold. Matt Duchesne literally standing at the blue line on the opposite side of the rink, but for some reason doesn't wait for Roman Josi to gain zone, negating a Kyle Turris goal. Crushing. And that's exactly what it felt like at the time. So The Predators, to their credit, did not hang their heads and stop playing after that.
I played well after it.
That's worth, you know, mentioning, and John Hines mentioned it afterward. They didn't stop playing, but you still thought at some point it's going to come down the other end, and like that breaks, lack of a break is going to lead to a break the other way for them.
And Joe, you wrote a column about this after the game, kind of talking about the play itself, but then some issues you have with the NHL and their access involved after. Just what were kind of some of the takeaways you had from that article?
Yeah, the point for me being, I think it's an NHL problem primarily, that the NHL should be a lot more forceful and proactive in terms of having full open locker room access after games like other pro sports do. We talked about earlier in the show, some college teams with unpaid players have way better access after the games than the Nashville Predators do. Again, the Predators are not alone. I think there are some teams that have better access from what I've been able to gather, some worse. But this is a situation where Matt Duchene, it's just a no-brainer, talks about that play. And I would be willing to bet that he would not have had a problem doing so. In a few months of being around him, I think he probably would have liked to have said something. Maybe I'm wrong. But regardless, it just should be an automatic. And in any other league, I
get paid $8 million a year.
Getting paid $8 million a year. Fans want to hear what were you thinking. And again, there may not be a great quote out of it. There may be a great quote out of it. That's not the point. The point is that it should be a no-brainer. And I now understand that the bubble situation makes it tougher. The bubble situation makes it no one's going into locker rooms now, and they're just picking two players and the coach. So I get that. But I think he should have been one of the two players. And good or bad, I think the NHL has this sort of impulse of let's not talk about stuff that we don't want to talk about, whereas Munson brought up the great example earlier about Taylor Lewan. He tests positive PEDs. So there's a whole press conference just devoted to Taylor Lewan answering questions about that. And look, I think Taylor Lewan, even though I don't think it was a comfortable press conference for him from start to finish, I think he wanted to explain himself. And that's the thing. We always think of it in terms of, oh, you're trying to, you know, rip on them or get after them, interrogate them, or going for clicks, whatever. Sometimes these people also would like to explain something about it that maybe you didn't know from watching on television. Regardless, it's an absolute necessity to have professional athletes available to speak after games, especially playoff games.
Agreed. And like you said, this is an NHL thing that has been bothering me for a while. I mean, I've been in every NHL locker room in this league, I don't know, probably 20 times over. And this is just a common thing in terms of the access could be better. And it could be better now, especially just because you have such an opportunity here to promote this game. I love hockey. I think it's the greatest game on the earth. But there's still a lot of things you could do from a league standpoint to promote yourself and promote your athletes a little bit more. And a lot of this, to be honest with you, Joe, is on the players themselves. Like, there's this culture in hockey that you don't put yourself above the team. And in a lot of ways, I respect that. I think that's good. I think that endears yourself to a lot of people. I think, quite honestly, a lot of fans love that about hockey, is that everything is about the team. Not a lot's about the individual persons. Like, they literally have a commercial running right now in the playoffs of how many times players in interviews say we. It's about, I think the title of the commercial is, it's about we, not I. And I get that. I think there's a certain respectability to that. I also think you got to start having more personality in the league. Like, you got to have some stars to relate to. Like, for instance, like Connor McDavid is probably a top two or three person in all of sports to watch perform right now. He is maybe the most boring athlete on the planet. Like, he is so monotoned. There's absolutely nothing exciting about that guy other than watching him play on the ice. Yes, you're going to get your hockey fan captivated by him by watching him play on the ice because they love hockey and they appreciate greatness. Your casual sports fan, a lot of them don't even know who Connor McDavid is, and a lot of that has to do with just how boring he is. That's got to stop with the NHL stars. Like, Sidney Crosby largely is the same way. A lot of this is on the players, too.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, some people just are, and that's how it is. Like, you probably aren't going to change that with Connor McDavid. You can enjoy the heck out of watching him. But on every single team, you can find any single sports team at any level, there are great human stories. I know this. And this is honestly the thing that I like best about this job, is finding those stories and writing them. I mean, look, the Predators, you know, Nick Barnowski, Emily Polanowicz, they helped me a lot get Predators' wives a couple weeks ago for a story about, you know, them and their, you know, the dads in the bubbles and things like that. Like, that's
great story.
I think people, not everybody likes it, but I think that kind of gives you a glimpse. John Hines' wife talked. She was great. I mean, just talking about the human side of this, we have Ryan S. Clark with Jacob Slavin and his wife, you know, adopting a black daughter and talking about what they've sort of discovered about the black experience in America just being her parents. It's an incredible story, tremendous story. There's another example of, you know, NHL people helping make that happen. So I think a lot of people get it, but I still think it has to come from the top down of, yes, you want those stories told, but also, like, you just automatically have people available to speak about things automatically, and they don't. And so players get used to that and are basically coddled. Predators players relative to Titans players are, I think the word coddled is accurate. They go into a back room after a game and they bring a couple guys out and talk for a few real brief minutes. Again, the Titans locker room, the whole thing's open. Half hour, whoever, whatever, go. This is how professional sports should be. It's how baseball is. It's how the NBA is. It's how the NHL needs to be.
And like we said, there's some logistical challenges that you have, but a lot of the logistical challenges in the NHL are the same as the NBA. I mean, the schedule is almost the exact same
right.
in terms of back-to-backs.
And they have pregame
games.
They have pregame availability, too. You go to open locker room before an NBA game.
Right, and you have that in the NHL
want.
In the mornings with the morning
skate, you're right.
Too.
I'm sorry. I apologize. This is true. It's farther away from the game, but
right.
you're right.
Right, but I hear what you're saying. Like, it's just it's a little bit different, even though the schedules are the same. So I thought an interesting point you raised in your column there, and you're very passionate about it. I'm glad you brought the passion today.
Well, we've talked about it a lot. We've talked about it a lot. And so, again, this isn't like anger that Matt Duchene didn't talk yesterday. It's, I think here's a good example to get after this topic. I'm not going to stop on this. And honestly, I think Professional Hockey Writers Association, I'm a member, you're a member. You know, we need to work together to talk to the NHL about this, too, because it can get better, and there are benefits for everyone if it does.
No question about it. When we come back, Hal Gill, Skillsy, will join us. We'll break down what happened in Game 3 and look ahead to Game 4 as well. That's next. This is Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Stream 102.5 The Game from anywhere. Download the Game Nashville app, enable our Alexa skill or Google Home, and ask to play 102.5 The Game or live stream from our website, thegamenashville.com. Welcome back in. Morning Drive. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexroad and talking about Game 3, looking ahead to Game 4 in the series between the Predators and the Arizona Coyotes. And to help us do that, we bring in our good friend Hal Gill, brought to you each week by Dunkin' Donuts. Skillsy, what's going on, man?
Not much, guys. Just getting my morning coffee and sorting out what's going on in the NHL and trying to keep up with all this madness.
It has been madness. I mean, we've got 2-12 seeds. Montreal leading Pittsburgh in the series, or Chicago leading Edmonton in the series. It's been a crazy playoff so far, Hal.
Yeah, a crazy game last night. I'm just trying to – I couldn't stay up that late. These are long days when you have a 1:30 game. But, yeah, it seems like every time I turn around, I'm watching a hockey game. But, yeah, some crazy hockey. I didn't see the Blackhawks being up 2-1. I didn't see the Preds being down 2-1 either. So Canadians up 2-1 over the Penguins. This is madness.
Hal, you brought up the Predators there, and obviously Game 3 yesterday didn't go the way they wanted it to go. I thought from an execution standpoint, first 40, 45 minutes of that game went about as well as you could have asked for the Predators. Darcy Kuemper played out of his mind. What did you take away from Game 3 and then what unfolded in the third period?
Yeah, it was tough. If I'm on the Preds, I'm, you know, you're scratching your head and going, all right, what do we have to do? You know, it comes down to, and this is the hard part about the playoffs is, you know, you can ride through the regular season and play as well as the Preds did and, you know, finish top two in your division. I really feel like they played that well. But in the playoffs, you have to win games. You have to win them not down the stretch. You can't just stick to the process and hope that you get wins. You got to change the narrative somehow. And so sometimes that means going out of your comfort box a little bit and maybe pushing and shoving, get into Kemper's kitchen and give him a jab, run him over, do whatever it takes to find a way to score goals, because they were doing everything right. They had shots. They had scoring chances. I feel like as the third period went on, they were squeezing their sticks a little bit, overthinking it. Sometimes you just got to simplify it and play a little bit more aggressive and a little harder as you're setting your edge towards the goal and play with a little more jam in your game. So I think they did everything right, but they got to find a way to turn it up a notch, because the Coyotes, they play that game. They kind of a rope-a-dope, and they wait for a high-skill play like Connor Garland. That was a beautiful goal he scored, and a nice setup from Stepan. And then you're looking at it going, oof, after the tourist goal gets wiped out, it's a tough pill to swallow. You got to find a way to power through those moments, though.
Yeah, you brought up the Garland goal there. I wanted to ask you that. If we have an imaginary telestrator here, what, from your perspective, happened on that play, and what should have happened on that play? Obviously, he made a great play, the toe drag, but before that, it looked like there was some confusion in the defensive zone.
Yeah, you have – well, it's – all right, so let's go with our telestrator. Stepan's coming down the wing. You keep him to the outside. It's really only one guy on the rush. So you keep him to the outside, turn him back. You should turn him back, and a forward should be there to take away any plays to the middle, and the D can close the gap. Stepan did a nice little button hook, goes up the wall, and finds Garland coming in with a ton of speed. But, Matthias Ekholm is right there on him. They have back checkers coming. And this is the moment that is hard for hockey fans to swallow, is he made a great play. He gets that pass, as Garland does, and pulls it a long toe drag around the stick of Ekholm. And then what's impressive to me, and if you've never been on skates and you've never tried to pull the puck into your skates and take a shot at that angle, it's not easy. He's got all his momentum going one way, and he's able to get a hard shot from inside of his skates and put it far post, inside the post, perfectly placed about 18 inches over Saros' pad, under the glove. It is a remarkable play, and you got to tip your hat to him. Could you have done things differently? Yeah, you could have come back and maybe, the defenseman closes the gap quicker on Stepan. I think that was Fabro, but I feel like he played that well. And Grimaldi can come back towards the middle and take away that pass, but I think he was trying to close space on Stepan. So the back checker is coming back through the middle. Yeah, can they cover Garland and help out a little bit more? Yeah, but they're in position to watch for the next guy coming into the play and leaving it to Ekholm. Ekholm makes a nice play. You're not expecting a guy to be able to toe drag it that far and get a shot off in his skates. And so Ekholm got fooled a little bit there. I don't know if anything gets played differently, but you know, the play was made and it was a beautiful play. And that happens in the playoffs. That's what the Preds need, is they need someone to go down and make that exceptional play on the other end. And Turris did that, and it was negated by an offsides. And you can blame DeShane all you want, but he's trying as hard as he can to get involved in that play, because if it's not Turris scoring the goal, he wants to be the guy that scores the goal. So it's a tough sequence that they went through, but I feel like if they play the right way and keep doing the right things, the hockey gods will come around and straighten everything up.
Preds radio analyst Hal Gill on the line with us, brought to you by Dunkin' Donuts. And Hal, you bring up the play by DeShane, and I kind of look at it two ways of, you look at it and you heard John Hines talk about it after the game. That's a detail you can't have. I understand that. I agree with that. And I think to a certain degree that played a part in what happened after that. But also, if you've been watching hockey for any length of time, traditionally, if it goes uncalled like that, it just is what it is, and you move on. But now that you have this review that's basically put in place to go back and eliminate these offsides plays that are just egregious, now we're looking at every minor detail of these offside plays, and that one had absolutely no impact on that goal being scored whatsoever. So I think both things can be true at the same time. Yes, you want more detail and attention to detail from DeShane,
Also, I don't think this is what the rule the NHL put into place is designed to do, is for these little ticky-tack offside plays.
Yeah, you can't have it both ways, though, right? And Duchesne was on, you know, the reason that was put in is because Duchesne blew through the neutral zone. It was a good 6 feet offside, and you say, that can't happen anymore. Guys, we got to put in replay, and then you put in replay, and you get all the little, you know, 1 inch here, 1 inch there, and yeah, it shouldn't matter, but every player on the ice knows that what offside is, and you can't be offside. that's the tough part of it, is Duchesne was offside, and you can look at it a million different ways and try to say, okay, it didn't matter, but what if Duchesne was the one who got that drop pass from Josi and scored the goal? Would you say he got an edge that he shouldn't have had? Well, it's a game of inches, right? Any given Sunday, it's a game of inches. And these inches are all around us, and you got to make sure you cover your inches.
So, Hal, you got the offsides, you got the goal, and then the Craig Smith penalty. So, obviously some big mistakes, but still a performance by a team that was overall pretty dominating, especially I think early. You know, the first 12 shots of the game, Darcy Kuemper really stepped up in this game. When you look at the overall performance, taking all that into account, if you're John Hines, would you consider any kind of switching or swapping, whether it be lines or, I guess, in goal, even though I think Saros was really good yesterday? Is it one of those things where maybe something like that might be good psychologically to say we're going to switch something up, or would you just stick with what you've been doing?
Yeah, his job, he's going to second guess and rethink and retool. He's going to consider the heck out of it. But I don't know what the right call is. You say, okay, let's put this guy in and he'll give us a little more on the floor check. Let's put this guy in. Maybe he can give us a little more defensively. But really, you know, you brought up mistakes. Every player made a bunch of mistakes. And if you had a mistake-free hockey game, it would be 0-0 and nothing would happen. And it would be boring as heck, you know? So all these mistakes are everywhere and you just hope your mistake doesn't cost the team. And that's what happened last night, is a couple mistakes cost the Preds a win. But if you look at the whole entirety of their work throughout the day, they did so many things well. I felt like they carried the play for most of that game, and they just weren't rewarded for it. So there's going to be tweaks. You got to do something different because you didn't win the game, but you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? I keep saying that, but you got to change something. You just got to figure out what it is, and that's the hard part for John Hines. Does he make a personnel change? You have two goalies that are great. Do you change that up? You have defensemen that aren't in the lineup. Should they be in the lineup? Does that make a difference? I thought all the defensemen played well. So maybe you keep them as is and you have confidence that the team is going to go out there and win the way they probably should have yesterday. So a lot to consider. There's a lot of answers, but we don't know what those answers are yet, and we'll find out. That's the fun part. We'll find out on Friday.
Hal, last thing for you here. You know, obviously we spent a lot of time talking about that top line heading into the series and how we need to see more from Johansson and what's Arvidsson going to look like now that he's healthy again. If I were to have told you that through three games that top line would have played as well as it has so far, and yet the Predators are still down 2-1 in the series, what would your reaction be?
Yeah, it's a good point, because I talked about this before the series started, is the top six need to shine. And right now you have the top three are shining. Johansson, I thought, was spectacular. He made some nice moves. Combination of his size and his stick handling and the way he was moving the puck. Forsberg all over the ice, getting a ton of looks and shots. Arvidsson coming down the wing, showing some signs of that speed burst that we know and love. I really think they all did their part. Now you need that second line, that second wave to come around and give a little more push. We've seen signs of Duchesne coming out. It hasn't been consistent. He needs to be, you see one or two plays. I need to see five or six wows from Duchesne, you know, not just one or two. Turris had the goal that was called back. That was a sign that he's getting around there the way he can play. He fought some good battles and got puck possession at times. I think Granlund is always playing a hard game. You just need that line to step up a little bit, and then it carries through. Then you have four lines going. I think everyone's doing their job, and that's when you win. You need everyone to step up. So I really like the Jofa line. I think everyone needs to kind of follow suit and keep going. That second line, if they can give you a little more, if they can contribute with a goal like they almost did, we're looking at a different series.
Yeah, did you think they were better from from the first two to the third game, Hal, that second line?
Yeah, the first game, they really didn't do much. I was disappointed. I thought they had a lot more to give. The second game, they had an offensive zone stretch where they were buzzing, a lot of movement. And that's the big thing for me. If you see that line moving, if you see Duchesne cutting back and forth behind the goal line and working in the corners, and you see Turris getting through the slot and picking up pucks and hounding pucks and keeping that offensive zone pressure going, and you see Granlund grinding in the crease and buzzing around the net, that's when that line is so effective. They got to keep their feet moving, and they did that for spurts. I thought in game three they did more of it. It's just got to be consistent. If they can do that consistently and be a threat the way that the Jofa line was almost every shift, that's so tough to defend against. And Coyotes, as much as they play rope-a-dope, they're just going to get exhausted. I thought they were getting tired. They were wearing them down. But you got to keep the throttle on, and that's where you need at least two lines going. And I think the Preds are close to it. They just need to up it another notch.
Hal Gill has been our guest here on Morning Drive, brought to you every week by Dunkin' Donuts. Hal, great stuff, my man. Thanks for joining us as always. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Hey, this is going to be a good game. Let's get Smashville turned up for it.
Absolutely. Hal Gill, ladies and gentlemen, brought to you by Dunkin' Donuts. We'll come back, wrap up the show, look ahead to Game 4. That's next. This is Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Final segment of the day here on Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, Joe Rexroad. Joe, obviously, a gigantic game tomorrow for the Predators in Game 4. It sounds simple, like, to me when I'm about to describe it to you this way. But my keys to the game 4, do pretty much exactly what you did yesterday in game 3 and take out those crucial mental mistakes and you'll be fine. That's pretty much my advice for the Predators.
And maybe, as Chris Mason pointed out on the broadcast, I do think that more traffic, more, you know, problems in front of Kemper,
yep,
can help too. They had a lot of people with the puck right in front of them. That's the thing. They had a lot of situations where a guy had the puck right in front of the goalie,
yes,
and he stopped it. But there is something to be said, too, for, you know, creating traffic and screening a goalie and not letting him see. And I think, obviously, the Coyotes' first goal was very much part of a strategy shift of sorts of,
yeah,
let's get some sticks up and redirect some pucks. So maybe they can do that better. And, I mean, look, like Hal Gale just said, it's a game of mistakes constantly. There, if you played it perfectly, I guess it's kind of like football. Well, if this play was executed, every play is drawn up to be a touchdown, you know. But there's mistakes all the time. It's just if you make the mistake at the bad time that either costs you a goal or gives them a goal, then you're going to lose. And so we're probably going to be looking at a close game in the third period tomorrow. And will the Preds execute and will they – be clutch? They just weren't clutch yesterday.
Yeah, and that's especially when you're talking about your big money guys. That's the same conversation we've had all season long. Now, Johansson was fantastic yesterday. Forsberg, Arvidsson, I thought were really good as well. So those big money guys, even though Arvidsson's not making a ton of money, those big money players responded really well, and I think have responded really well all series long. Now it's Turris, Duchesne, Granlund. You got to have it from those guys. I mean, it's put up or shut up time from that second line. Being dangerous is great. That's fine. I agree with what Hal said. I thought They looked pretty good in game two, that line did. They looked okay at times yesterday. You got to score. It's time to put the puck in the back of the net if you're Granlund or Turris, Duchesne especially. It's time to earn the money that you're making in big situations right now with high pressure, everything on the line, backs against the wall. You got to put the puck in the back of the net, man. That's what it's got to happen tomorrow.
Yeah, and John Hines has done a lot of switching, mixing, matching, trying to figure out his team when he came. Then you had the pause. The lines we see are the exact lines that we saw all through camp. They've been consistent. It's have that continuity, have that chemistry. But I will ask you, first of all, let's be clear. No one's getting benched on the second line.
That's
ridiculous. And you would never bench Matt Duchesne for what he did yesterday. You need him to respond to that. But I will ask you, is there any sense in looking at some kind of a move to mix up that second line, bring someone up from the third, move someone down from two to three, and just try to get a little bit of a different feel on those, especially on that one line that right now is not pulling its weight?
Only move that I could see on the second line making sense in terms of just a pure structure of the line, in my opinion, would be like taking Forsberg off the first line and putting him on the second line and added some bulk there.
Zero.
They're not going to do that. Like, yeah. It's not going to happen.
Not
like
the way those guys are.
That Johansson line's playing too well. So you can't do that. So, like, if you swapped out Kyle Turris with Craig Smith or Mikael Granlund for Craig Smith, yeah, you've changed the lines. But have you really changed, like, the makeup of the lines at that point? I would argue no. I mean, we saw it in the Winnipeg series a couple years ago. It was Fiala, Turris, Smith. Line didn't do anything, because they did not get to the areas that you need to get to. I think Craig Smith's been okay, I guess, in this series at doing that. But I don't think moving him up to the second line and dropping Granlund down to the third or dropping Turris down to the third really changes up that dynamic much. So
the dynamic would be getting heavier. And, yeah, like you said, obviously a lot of this year they tried Forsberg and Duchesne together, I think, for that reason. But, yeah, you can't mess with those guys, with what they're doing. You have to hope they, carry you to victory tomorrow more than anything.
I will say this, a simple adjustment you can make, I mean, you can leave the lines the exact same. I'm looking at those three tomorrow, and then I'm looking at Ryan Ellis and Roman Josi. And if I'm John Hines, hey, if this game's close, I'm playing you until your feet fall off. Like, you're going to be playing every other shift.
27 minutes?
Like, if you're Josi and Ellis, I would be prepared to play them 28, 29, 30 minutes tomorrow.
Whew.
If you're that Johansson line, especially if it's close in the third period, you got to have your best line out there, man. So, typically they probably play, 17, 18 minutes a game. I'm cranking that up towards in the 20s tomorrow if I'm John Hines. Assuming, of course, they can handle it, because, look, that's a lot to ask when you hadn't played a ton of hockey lately. You've been off for a long time. Conditioning is a thing, and it is a concern right now, and you just played back-to-back game. So there is a huge conditioning concern, but especially if it's close, when you're back up against the wall, if I'm John Hines, I'm wearing those guys into the ground, because you don't really have a choice. Like, you've got to win.
Some of Pred's Twitter told me that it should have been Pekka. This proved it should have been Pekka. It should definitely be Pekka in game four. Give me your – we'll do the 0 to 100 thing again. Percentage chance that UC Saros is replaced by Pekka Rinne in game four.
I'll say this. I don't think it's likely. I do think it's more likely that Pekka plays tomorrow than I thought it was he was going to play yesterday in terms of the back-to-back situation. I think I put it at like 90-10 Saros yesterday. I'd go 75-25.
Okay, that's a pretty healthy. I think I'd go 85-15 Saros. I mean, basically it's just a psychological move, but it's not a performance move to me.
No,
Saros is your guy.
But I think, the psychological part of it's something you got to take into account. So that's why I kind of give that percentage chance a little higher. That's going to do it for us today. We'll be back tomorrow to look ahead at game four, a crucial game four for the Nashville Predators. Joe, good show today.
You too, buddy.
Absolutely. This is Morning Drive. Darren, Donick, and Chase coming up next. You're listening to ESPN 102.5 The Game.